You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hello and welcome everybody to the offices of the Open Society Foundations. My name is Stephen Hubbell. I'm with the Open Society Fellowship Program, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this conversation between Michael Sfard, who was an Open Society Fellow a few years ago, and Rabbi Jill Jacobs, in honor of the publication last month of Michael's new book, The Wall and the Gate, Israel, Palestine, and the Legal Battle for Human Rights, which was published by Metropolitan Books. And now the words legendary human rights litigator don't come tripping naturally off the tongue. The reasons for that are probably fairly obvious. Human rights litigation, as our colleagues here at the Open Society Justice Initiative can attest, tends to be complex enough, context-specific enough, sometimes tedious enough, and certainly protracted enough to make even the most dedicated layperson to make their eyes glaze over. On top of which, it is often the case that one might wait many years to achieve a victory in a court of law, only to see that victory rapidly unraveled in the court of public opinion, or by the caprices and whims of legislatures or authoritarian leaders. In addition to which, human rights lawyers and litigators themselves often shun the limelight, preferring to focus instead on their clients and on the legal landscape before them. Now, the extent to which Michael Sfard, who is actually deserving of the title human rights litigation legend, will shun the limelight came clear to me a couple of months ago in Sarajevo, where we were both present for a conference. I got an urgent email from his editor at Metropolitan Books, Reva Hocherman, who's an old friend and sitting out there. She said that the art director would really like another image for publicity and possibly for the author photo. Now, unlike Michael, I'm not one to shun the limelight, and I was eager to be the author of the iconic image that would propel Michael into the public imagination here in the United States, North America, and in Israel, too. So he and I went out of the hotel and walked along a little bit, and I was trying to get the river just right in the background and the light just perfect. And it became clear pretty quickly that Michael was losing patience with all of this. And none of the images that I finally came up with, I'm sorry to say, made the cut, but that's a story for another day. As time wore on, I realized that to Michael, what matters really is the words on the page, the ideas, and not the person who conveys them. And with that in mind, I will say nothing more than I commend you to read this. And I will add that we are here at the Open Society Foundations, so very proud of this book and honored to have been able to play a small role in its creation. We're also so very proud of the life that Michael leads and the work that he does and his courage and honesty in committing that life and that work to these pages. I'd also like you to join me, please, in welcoming Rabbi Jill Jacobs to the Open Society Foundations. Jill is the executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, which mobilizes rabbis and cantors and tens of thousands of American Jews to advocate and protect human rights in North America and in Israel. A leading voice on Jewish social justice, she is the author of Where Justice Dwells, a hands-on guide to doing social justice in your Jewish community, and There Shall Be No Needy, pursuing social justice through Jewish law and tradition. So welcome, Jill, and thank you for presiding over today's conversation. Two small pieces of housekeeping. First of all, this is being recorded for posterity for a video podcast on the Open Society website. Secondly, there will be a Q&A afterwards, and I invite you, when that starts, to line up behind that microphone, identify yourselves, and in the spirit of the question and answer, please do try to come up with a question rather than a protracted statement. So thank you all for being here, and now over to you, Jill.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for hosting this and also for making it possible for Michael to write this amazing, important book. I want to start with a little bit of an introduction to Michael, who, as you've already heard, is one of Israel's leading human rights lawyers. He's a former conscientious objector and a recipient of the Emil Grunzweig Human Rights Award, as well as an Open Society Fellowship, which, as you've heard, is how he was able to have the time to write this book. His writing on human rights has appeared in the New York Times, in Haaretz, The Independent, and Foreign Policy. And he lives in Tel Aviv. And I'll just say that as somebody who works on human rights both in the U.S. and also in Israel and the occupied territories, Michael is a person who I call when I have a question about a legal issue. And he is just so incredibly generous with his time, so incredibly knowledgeable about everything that is happening in Israel and the occupied territories. And it's just really a pleasure and an honor to be here with you. Thank you. I wanted to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book. Certainly, there are many things that you could be doing with your time, any demands on your time, and what contribution you were hoping to make with this book.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Steve. It's been a great 2 weeks when I'm on a tour of different talking events, but it's especially exciting for me to be here. I see friends, so many friends here, and being at the Open Society, which basically gave me the opportunity to write this book, and the year here had a profound impact, a defining impact on my career, on my life, on my family's life. So thank you. I want to thank the Open Society and specifically the fellowship program, which allowed me to do that. when I went to law school, by the way, I did not know when I went to the university that I eventually would apply for the law school. When I came back, my parents were quite amazed that this is what I chose. I'm not sure they were happy back then. But when I've decided to become a lawyer, it was clear to me that I want to do human rights law, that I want to litigate human rights law. And I think it was a way to escape politics. I wanted to make an impact on the community where I live in. I wanted to influence the normative framework of where I that governs the place where I will have my kids live in. And I thought that law is another avenue for doing that. And human rights law is the field of law that could allow me to pursue the kind of values that I believe in. And once I've decided that human rights law is the field that I want to practice, as an Israeli, it was immediately clear to me that the struggle that I want to lend whatever talent I have is the struggle to end the occupation, the Israeli occupation over the Palestinian territories. I'm not sure. I know that all of you know quite a lot about the occupation, but let me frame the issue of why I think the struggle against the occupation is so maybe the most important struggle for any Israeli today. I'll be 46 in April, and I have friends in Ramallah and other places in the West Bank, Palestinians, who are my age, and they have not experienced one day of liberty in their lifetime. If they want to go on a summer vacation abroad to Paris or London or New York, they need a permit from the Israeli military commander. If they want to build a house, they need a building permit from the planning boards, which are part of the civil administration and an Israeli military institution. If they want to demonstrate, they need a permit from the military commander. They are governed by norms that they have not been involved in forming. They have no right to be elected or to vote to the corridors of power where their fate and future is being decided. And that has been so for 5 decades and still counting. And that has affected millions of people who are stripped of their civil rights. So for me, it was clear that as an Israeli, I have responsibility to engage in the movement to end the occupation. And I thought back then that by doing that decision, of course, I get into a field where success is scarce, and there are many, many hardships. It's a walk up the hill, maybe up the mountain, maybe up the Everest. But at the same time, at least, I know that at any given point, I know exactly which path to take. It's very clear to me. I want to fight for the good guys and not allow the bad guys to get away with bad things. And during my work as a human rights lawyer in this arena and in this topic, it gradually dawned on me that I was naive. That thinking that it is very easy to decide what to do ignores the complexities, the nuances, and the paradoxes that human rights litigation brings when the litigation is conducted and managed by cause lawyers, but by lawyers, by legal activists who see themselves not only as lawyers who pursue remedy, pursue a case to secure remedy for their clients and relief for their suffering or their abuse, but also want to contribute to an overall change, to a policy change, in this case to a regime change, because I consider myself part of the movement to end the Israeli occupation over the West Bank, to end the military rule there. And I'll give you one example. I'm sorry for this long answer, but it's a question that merits long answer. I'll give you one example, and just an example that there are many like it, and the example is the one that lent the name to my book, The Wall and the Gate. As you all know, Israel has embarked on a national project of erecting a separation barrier, a big, big project of erecting a system of walls and fences inside the occupied territories. And it was a reaction to a popular Israeli demand to create a barrier in the face waves of terror attacks on its cities, towns, buses, cafes, etc. And the popular demand for a barrier was understandable, but the government of Israel has decided to manipulate and to exploit that demand in order to build a barrier that would not be rooted on the internationally acknowledged border between Israel and Palestine, meaning the Green Line, the armistice lines that were agreed on in 1949 between the State of Israel and the Kingdom of Jordan, but rather to sketch a route that would invade the West Bank, to build the fence on the lawn of the neighbor, and thus fencing or walling out thousands of Palestinians from their farmlands. And I was involved in challenging several segments of this barrier, which I and my colleagues thought it was not only a grave violation of international law, but also a daylight robbery of lands. That was the intention of the architects of the fence. And I was asked to meet two heads of villages in the Kalkilia area, and these two communities have lost more than 1,200 densely cultivated dunams of densely cultivated olive groves. And for 2 years already, when I met them, they have not had they lost any access to their lands. And they told me how like 50% of the families in their communities lost more than 80% of their annual income because of the ceiling of their property, of their lands. And they asked me, what can we do? We were sitting in this gas station overlooking the closed areas. And I looked at the aerial photos, and I looked at the scene, and I told them, I told them back then that I thought there was a very good case that we have, a strong case, because the fence was so far away from the houses of the nearby settlement, which supposedly it is supposed to protect, and according to the standards the army itself presents in court, they need 400 meters of buffer zone, that is the effective range of light weapon, when in fact they built the barrier 2,000 meters, 2 kilometers away from the houses. So I told them, I think we have a good chance, I think we have a good case, let's go to court, let's petition the court, demand to dismantle that uh, that fence. So that these two gentlemen asked me, so how long would it take to litigate such a case? And I said, well, if it's really quickly, then it will take 2 years. More likely three, you should take into account four. They looked at each other and then looked at me again and said, Mr. Sfard, could you ask that a gate would be installed in the fence? And that way we could, when they opened the gate for us, we could cross and harvest our trees. And I thought, wow, I definitely could get them a gate. Not only that I could get them a gate, the army would be very happy to negotiate with me a gate. These were the days when the pressure on Israel and the criticism on Israel for erecting this fence wall was mounting. It was a photojournalistic disaster, the barrier project, with scenes of olive trees being uprooted and farmland, open farmland, being cut off by concrete walls. And the army, I thought to myself, this is exactly what the army wants me to do. It wants me to be the middleman that will help it better manage the wall. So I could get some relief to my clients, but at the same time, I will cooperate with perpetuating this fence that I think is a daylight robbery. What should I do? Now, these kind of questions have been haunting me throughout the years. There were many other cases where I thought, am I a naive collaborator of the system? Isn't the work with the occupier in its courts, in its justice system, makes the whole human rights work a joint venture with the government? And do I shorten the shelf life of the occupation, or do I contribute to its stability? And whenever I thought these questions, I thought I need time to really think it over and to learn from the experience of my predecessors. And fortunately, I got the Open Society Fellowship, which allowed me not only to have the time, but also to go away from the region, because you cannot be there and still do that. And the product is my book. Wonderful. Sorry for this long answer. But
no, it was wonderful. It was also a good introduction to some of the challenges that you deal with in the book. I was really struck when I was reading your book at how Jewish it was. You're being interviewed by a rabbi. You knew it was coming. you talk in the beginning about the concept of Tzelem Elohim, or the idea that human beings are created in the divine image. You quote Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's probably the greatest Jewish prophet of the 20th century. You reference it at one point. You talked about making an argument from Jewish law about collective punishment against collective punishment. There are a number of other instances. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little about what it means to you to be doing this work as a Jew, and where Judaism fits in with your life's work.
If there is one issue that really drives me crazy, is the fact that Judaism in my country was hijacked by a certain stream. Judaism has many faces, 70 faces the Torah has. Yeah. Judaism has many faces. It's not made of one skin. It has many streams. And today, the country that purports to be the homeland for the Jewish people is speaking on behalf of a very extreme, nationalistic, to the point of racist type of Judaism. I was brought up on a different type of Judaism. Not only that I was brought up on a different type of Judaism, but I read and I know the history, or I hope that I know quite a bit about the history of the Jewish people, and I do not, and I get really angry to think that that we in Israel have not learned the obvious lessons that should have been learned from our own collective biography. And so not only that, when I litigate my cases, and when I write op-eds, and when I wrote the book, it is important for me to represent the universal values of you know, sanctity of human life, the right of every, you know, the humanistic values, which I definitely believe in and am part of. But also it is important to me to try to release Judaism as it is seen by those who look at Israel from the chains that it was that have been put on it, because I think that Judaism has contributed to the international moral thinking some of its most important values, humanistic universal values, and unfortunately today it's not being seen. So this is, if you ask me what does me being Jewish or my Judaism has to do with this, this is another seed that makes me tick. In parallel to my being a human being, seeing other people in suffering, seeing other people subjugating by my brethren.
Thank you. I want to ask you about another term that has sometimes that has gotten a bad rap, and that's Zionism. That there is a lot of people who have a very specific definition of what Zionism is, whether from the right, the left, somewhere else. And you were recently quoted in an interview in Haaretz saying, if Zionism is a belief or the desire that the Jewish people will have a place where they can exercise their right of self-determination as a nation, and that place is here, then I'm a Zionist. If being a Zionist means thinking that this should come at the expense of other people who live here and they should become second-class citizens, then I'm not a Zionist. And I'm wondering if you can expand on that a little bit and talk to us about whether you think that Zionism is something that can be saved, whether you do consider yourself a Zionist, and what does that mean?
The fact that we're asking this question means that there is a crisis in Zionism, because I was born and raised as a Zionist. My parents have fled Poland after severe anti-Semitic policy by the government, by the Polish government, has resulted in the exodus of whatever was left of Jewish community in Poland after the Holocaust, and they found refuge in Israel. And so the mere fact that we're asking the question if I can relate to Zionism means that there is a crisis with Zionism. As a human rights activist and as a person who believes in the humanistic values, it is of utmost importance to me to ask, what do people want? We can criticize the desires of people to have a nation state, but if we take seriously the notion that human beings are sacred, and their aspiration, their pursuit of happiness, their pursuit of realization of their being, their autonomy, is something that we cherish and want, and we are obligated to advance, then the fact that that there are millions of people who want to have to exercise self-determination in a way of having a state that would be a homeland for their people is something that we have to take to respect. By the way, between the Jordan River and the sea, there are millions of people, and almost all of them have these aspirations. Those who want to have Israel as a Jewish, as a state of, I want you to pay attention to the words that I choose. I don't believe Israel should be a Jewish state. I don't know what it means to be a Jewish state. I've been to Chicago a few days ago, and someone came to me and gave me his card and said, I'm from a Jewish law firm. And I asked, what does it mean to be a Jewish law firm? Was it converted? Did it go to the synagogue? What does it mean to? I don't understand what it means to be a Jewish state. I know what it means that a state is a homeland for certain people, but it shouldn't be exclusive. Israel can be a homeland for the Jewish people and also a homeland for Palestinians who have Israeli nationality. And many Palestinians, those who are live in the occupied territories and their diaspora, want to have a nation state in the form of Palestine. So for me, it's not just a particular Jewish issue. It's the collective group right of these people to exercise their culture, their religion, their history in the form of a political entity.
So you talked, as you were answering this question, about language, and specifically you talked about the difference between Jewish state and state of the Jews, state of the Jewish people, and language comes up a lot in your book. And in particular, you deal with the question of, well, do we call what's happening in the West Bank an occupation? That's certainly a debate that is live and raging in many places. Israel, of course, calls that space disputed, the disputed territories, as opposed to occupied territories. You also deal with the question of, is it apartheid, what's happening there? And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the importance of language and why, in your opinion, it is important to get the words right. So both why you do choose to use the word occupation and also why you're invested in that language or in any language.
Right. So, you know, I'm not the philosopher of language, but I think it's quite basic stuff to say that language not only portrays reality, it also creates reality. Because people are, when they have concepts, when they hear concepts, they relate to it. And language is many times not only a descriptive tool, but also a lens, glasses, through which you see reality. And so I'll give an example in the beginning of the first decade of the century, in the 2000s. It was the first time that I heard the word apartheid being used in relation to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. I think the first term that I heard was the apartheid wall. And I remember saying to myself, well, words are important, and words should not be taken lightly. Not every murder is a genocide, and not every discrimination is apartheid. And if we use the terms too lightly, then they lose their meaning. And apartheid is a serious allegation. And I rejected the notion that there is any characteristic of the Israeli regime in the occupied Palestinian territories that has to do anything with apartheid. But the doubt was still in me. And what lawyers usually do when they are not sure about something, they open a new file. So I opened a new file in my office. I wrote on it apartheid ? And whenever I had some documents or some articles or cases that I thought could shed some light on the question, I placed it in that file. And that file became very thick. And then I created a PowerPoint presentation out of it. And unfortunately, I did reach the conclusion that the traits of the Israeli government in the occupied territories, given that we have colonized the territory, given that we have created a reality in which there are two communities in the West Bank. One is completely stripped of their rights, and the other has all the rights, has all the political power, the connection, and the ability to influence their fate. The fact that different laws, to a large extent, apply to each community. The fact that the government of the territory, the military government, is applying practices and policies to make sure that those two communities would be separated. And by the way, Israel uses a lot of euphemisms to clear and to whitewash its deeds. So we don't have extrajudicial executions. We have preventive killings. We don't have, we don't have torture. We have enhanced, this is also here in America, enhanced interrogation techniques. So, but someone disregarded or fell in while being on guard, and separation, state separation, which means that the philosophy of separation, which is governing the way the army governs the two communities under its rule, is being termed in the same way that in Afrikaner it's apartheid, apartness. And so when I thought of all of this together, and when I've looked directly at the reality, I got to the conclusion that yes, the reality in the West Bank does meet at least the legal definition of the crime of apartheid. I still would not dismiss the term occupation. I still think that the fact that I can describe the regime in the West Bank as apartheid does not rule out that at the same time it is also an occupation, a military occupation. And the importance of that is that a military occupation is a status. It's a status which imposes duties, obligations, but also powers to the occupying force. And it also means that under international law, this is not sovereignty. Sovereignty cannot be acquired through force, and occupation should be temporary and should be ended by negotiations and by consent. So the importance of terming this reality as occupation has legal implications, and the importance of understanding that we have reached a point where that occupation is also an apartheid regime is important because of the moral moral consequences of this, and also the legal ones.
So I want to ask a little bit more about that term occupation, particularly because, as I said before, it's contentious in some circles even to say that the West Bank is occupied. We hear disputed, we hear administered, we hear all sorts of other euphemisms for what's happening there. And on the other hand, there are some people on the other side of the political equation who argue that actually all of Israel, not only the West Bank, but also Israel proper, is an occupation or is apartheid. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the legal differences between Israel inside of the Green Line, inside of the Armistice Line, and in the West Bank.
Israel was created after the Second World War, and after the new international order, at the center of which is the United Nations, was formed. Israel was established according to a UN resolution. And so any argument that says that, at least legally speaking, Israel is a colonial project, that Israel is an illegal state, has no grounds in international law. Israel was established according to a decision of the international community, a decision that was never revoked, a decision that actually was reaffirmed many, many times. The same resolution also called for an establishment of a Palestinian state, something we're still to apply, to implement, to realize. Now, the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem were conquered in 1967, and the same institutions that decided that to establish two states in the region have also issued resolutions, very clear resolutions, which say that A, these areas are occupied in the sense of that term under international law, and B, that Israel has to retreat from these territories in order to allow the partition plan and the creation of a Palestinian state to be realized. So, as a lawyer that is exercise international law, I have no question about the legality of the establishment of the state of Israel and the illegality of the continued occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights, which is a different story. illegality in the sense not that occupation itself is illegal. International law acknowledges that in times of war, an army, let's take the passive term, an army can find itself effectively controlling areas that are beyond the sovereign borders of the state that sent it. So it's not illegal to be occupying another territory. What is illegal is to engage in a policy towards that territory that would perpetuate the control rather than lead to the end of occupation. And of course, Israel has done anything it could, everything it could, including colonizing it, including changing its landscape, its demography, and robbing the inhabitants of the territory, the occupied people who are termed under international law as protected persons, from their resources, from their rights, from their liberties, etc. So for me, it's very clear that there is a vast difference, a world difference between the legal framework that has to do with the establishment of Israel and the legal framework that governs the occupied territory.
Thanks. I want to go back to the story that you told about the wall and the gate that gave the book its name. You talk a lot about the concepts of winning and losing, success and failure, and suggest that sometimes winning and success aren't the same thing, or you could lose but win, or you mix up those terms a lot. And you talk, in particular, you say that there are three possible goals that one might have, that you get a remedy for your client, that there's policy change, and there's regime change. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about how you see winning, losing, success, failure, and particularly along those three goals.
Right. Well, when you go to law school because you saw a lot of American court dramas, as I have, you get the notion that law is about winning or losing. This American, very American concept that it's a binaric situation. Either you won or you lost. And that's true, by the way. It's true when for regular litigation, when you go to court, many times the question is very simple. In order to assess the success of your litigation, the question is, did you secure a remedy, the remedy that was sought in this litigation for your client? If you did, that's a victory. If you didn't, that's a fail. That's a defeat. The problem gets, the issue gets more complicated and more nuanced when you have more than one goal. Getting remedy for your client is just one level, but there are other dimensions. And in the other dimensions, you aspire that litigation to contribute to a more wider change, to a policy change. So I go to court on behalf of a client in order, let's say, to make sure that he will not be tortured. He or she would not be tortured. And I get a remedy. I get an injunction against the whatever security force that holds him or her. I got a remedy for this individual. But I hope to get a precedent that would say that no matter who is the client, no matter who is the interrogee or the suspect, it is not allowed to use physical measures in their interrogation. That's a policy change. So my function, which asks, is this a success story or not, has two variables. The question of getting a remedy for the client, and also the question of what is the impact of this litigation on the overall policy. Now, if that's not complicated enough, when you fight an evil regime, and I think that by today there is no way to other to define the Israeli occupation over the West Bank and the colonization of the West Bank, but an evil regime, you not only want to end torture. It's not enough to say that to end, let's say, land expropriation for settlers. We also want to end the occupation. We want a regime change. Now we have three levels of objectives to our litigation. A very, very mighty task. So not really that we believe or aspire that a certain litigation would bring about the end of the occupation, but we want our litigation to contribute to the movement for ending the occupation. And now we have Now it's even worse. We have a formula with three variables. You know, a formula with three variables means that the solving it is three-dimensional, right? It's no longer just a parabola or whatever. And so in order to assess our work, we need to look at the different levels of the impact it has. And when we and in this book, what I try to do is to study 4.5 decades of litigation, hundreds of cases, dozens of legal struggles that were composed each of many, many cases, and to see what was their impact and how did it work, and what was the result of these cases. And what I learned was that even though we have a tendency to believe that a victory in a case is a milestone towards a success, meaning an over contributing to the more far-reaching change, and a defeat in court is a milestone towards a failure, that is not really always the case. And sometimes the impact of a defeat can be a backlash that would actually ignite a political process that would lead to success, that would lead to changing perceptions and allowing a re-examination of the status quo, and vice versa. Sometimes a victory can lead us instead of to a success. It can lead to failure because of the backlash it will create, or because of all kinds of effects. For example, a victory can silence many of the progressives who would otherwise go out to the street and say, "Okay, the court has ruled, and the people are protected. We don't need to invest too much in that thing." So this very erratic framework calls for lawyers, for litigators, and for movements for change to think very carefully and strategize their work to understand how the impact of their litigation, what kind of impact it has on the overall struggle. Thanks.
I've been thinking a lot about something that you said to me in your office in Tel Aviv a few weeks ago, that you said that it used to be that your work was primarily defending people who were the victims of human rights violations, and now your work has moved much more to defending the defenders. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that work of defending the defenders and what the situation is for human rights defenders in Israel today.
I've been in this business, not such a good business, but this line of work for almost 2 decades now. And in the first decade, it was a very pleasant moment in every meeting with foreign correspondents, with diplomats who came to Israel and were stationed there. It was always a very pleasant moment after criticizing my government for an hour and saying, you know, harsh things about its policies, and even questioning their intentions. But then there was always this point where I said, you know, but there is one good thing I want to say about the country I live in and the society that I live in. I'm free to say what I want, and I'm free to operate, and they respect us human rights activists and lawyers for doing what we do. And there is real pluralism in Israel, and a guarantee for freedom of speech. And it's probably one of the most shameful thing and embarrassing things that I cannot say that anymore. In the last decade, there has been the whole concept of our liberal democracy, whether it was really there or it was a mirage, but nevertheless, at least the declaratory position of the heads of our state was always that we are a liberal democracy, which entails several things, among them freedom of speech and so on. It has changed, it has shattered completely. There are many reasons why. That's for another book. But basically, Israel is going through an illiberal wave where we no longer speak about ideas. Instead, the government is, and it's, I call it GONGOs, the governmental, non-governmental organizations that are the satellites, the right-wing satellites of the government, are targeting dissenting voices, inciting against them, branding them as traitors, as agents of foreign powers, and initiating a tsunami of bills that are meant to restrict our speech, restrict our work, shut down the sources of our funding, all in the service of perpetuating the Israeli control over the West Bank. And then there was November 8, 2016. And whatever restrictions, whatever curbing forces there were on the Israeli right have been lifted. And today what we see is that Israel, the government of Israel and its right-wing allies and pro-settler lobby, which is the strongest lobby in Israel, is ready to sacrifice every image of democracy in Israel in order to completely annihilate opposition. It's a very Putinistic type of thinking. The way it is being done is takes a lot of examples from Putin. I have to say that we have not seen a new. It's not like the old reality was replaced by a new one. What we're seeing is a war. We're seeing a struggle between different sides of the Israeli society, different personalities. I usually term it as the Israeli split personality. Our very nationalistic, very illiberal, almost fascist part of our soul is fighting to kill or to annihilate the other person in our soul, which is a more liberal and one that is loyal to liberal values. And this is a war for the soul of the Israeli society. Now, what I told you in Tel Aviv in my office was that when I look at the portfolio of the work of my office, I can see that change. Because if I look at what I've been doing, what my time was being invested in 10 years ago, 100% of my time was invested in litigating on behalf of the direct victims of human rights violations in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, meaning Palestinians, individuals and communities, and Palestinians in Israel, Bedouin tribes, etc. Today, I would say that 30 to 40, maybe even more percent of my work is to help activists secure the space for them to be active. Both Israeli activists who are targeted, but also internationals who are not even let into the country because of their political views.
Thanks. So now that you've told us about some of the unfortunate negative changes in Israeli society, I want to bring us to a little bit of hope because I think that actually you've been a very strong voice of hope. And in particular, I'm thinking about an op-ed that you wrote that you also say some of the same things in the book, where you say, one day the occupation will end, and you say it really clearly. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about how you hold on to that hope that one day the occupation will end, and about resiliency. You've been doing this work for a long time and hopefully have many, many more years of doing human rights law work, and I'm wondering what keeps you going? How do you maintain that sense of hope and that resiliency when things are as hard as they often are?
Well, I'll start with the resiliency because it's the easy part to answer. I'm addicted. It's not like I have a choice. By now it became an addiction. I cannot live in Israel and feel responsible for what is being done in my name without doing this work. I believe that the occupation is an Israeli project. It's not a project of only of those Israelis who support it. Even though I do not man the checkpoints and I'm not a settler and I actually oppose the occupation policy and try to fight against it, I'm still an Israeli. And as an Israeli citizen, national, I contribute to my society and I get a lot from being a citizen. And so I have responsibility, collective responsibility, for the occupation. Even if, and that's where the famous saying by Rabbi Joshua Heschel that in a free society, some are guilty but all are responsible for atrocities. So I'm not guilty. I have no mens rea. I have done a lot, whatever I could to stop the crime, not to assist it. But I am responsible. As every Israeli is, and what it means to be responsible, it means that I have an obligation, the obligation to resist, and so resiliency sounds very it's a very noble thing, but I think of it as something that is we don't have much choice. This is what we have to do, and even if we don't think that it would that there is any hope, we still have to do it. Because there are people on the other side who ask for our solidarity. And these bridges that are created by the human rights community in Israel and the Palestinians is one that has been maintained in the worst of days when violence has plagued the land. And it is, and even when it seems like there is no theory of change, this has to be maintained. There's no other way. As for why I think that the occupation will end, I have been branded as an optimist, which...
It's not a bad thing.
Well, some people think that basically... they say that I'm an optimist in order not to say that I'm stupid. because people think of this kind of optimism as one that is great, is based on belief. And belief doesn't have to be rational. It doesn't have to be based on some logics. It's a belief. I believe that. This is not why I say that I think that the occupation will end. I do think that there is a rational explanation which leads to the inevitability of the ending of the occupation. I'm very smart, though. I don't say which date it will happen. And the reason is that I think that human history teaches us that subjugating millions of people, a regime that strips people from their rights and holds them and oppresses them, is a regime that by definition is unstable. By definition. I haven't come across yet any group of people that are very happy at being rightless, of not controlling their fate, their future. And Palestinians are no different. And this vicious cycle of uprising and the need to place oppression measures that are even more draconian than the ones before, and then the counter-violence that is even worse than before, this is a part of oppressing people. And so I believe that this kind of regime could have lasted for decades, for centuries in the past, but it doesn't. It can't last forever in our age. I also think that one of the reasons people do not believe in the possibility of ending the occupation is because they look at the situation and they say, well, if such a monumental change is in the cards, we should see its signs, right? When we travel somewhere, we expect to see us advancing. We go to a certain city by car, and we see a road sign saying you're 50 miles away. Then you see a road sign saying you're 40 miles away. You are advancing. And we don't see that. We look to the sideways, we look back and forth, and we don't see any signs for the occupation to end. But the thing is about these kind of changes, historical changes, that they not necessarily happen in a linear way. All the experts on the Soviet bloc, all of them, have not anticipated the fall of the Berlin Wall even a month before it happened. All the, we have, I think, the most popular faculties in Israel are the ones that teach about Arabs. We have experts about Palestinians, about Arabs, you know, like sand on the sea. None of them knew that the Arab Spring would erupt. None of them knew that the first Intifada will explode. None of them knew that the second Intifada will start. And what about the apartheid in South Africa, which collapsed again without anyone anticipating from before? And the reason is for that is because we are because the changes are happen beneath the ground. There are all kinds of cracks that are being formed underneath the ground. And these cracks are not seen for those who stand over ground. And when they are enough cracks and when they are wide enough, then suddenly everything collapses like a sinkhole. And everybody's surprised. And as I said in that op-ed back then, and when it happens, when the apartheid fell, or when the occupation will end, suddenly we'll discover that everyone was against it. The academia and the arts, and everyone was in a fierce battle to end it. So I don't know when it will end, and I'm not sure that it will end peacefully. But I do believe that it, I do think that it will end, and the implication of thinking that it will end is the following, and this is where people usually really roll their eyes. We have to think of the day after. Because there were so many regimes, evil regimes, that ended only to be replaced with worse regimes. And if we do not think of the day after the occupation, we are risking that the end of occupation will not bring the kind of reality that respects human beings and invests in their well-being, their happiness, and their autonomy. And I think that one of our roles as people who are engaging in work for social change is also to think that far.
Great, thank you. With that, I'm going to open this up to questions. And the way to ask a question is, thank you for demonstrating. You can get behind that mic, or if you're not able to get up, just raise your hand and we will figure it out. And again, please keep your questions to a question. We're going to take three at once. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Just say your name so we know how to refer back to you. And
My name is Abdine Jabbar, and my question relates to BDS. I think BDS has been adopted now by the international anti-occupation forces, and that Israel today is spending tens of millions of dollars to combat it. And you say that your work today now is defending the defenders. What does this mean for the people in Israel? I understand there's only three people in prison for conscientious objection. I just read this in Harper magazine. And I would like to know what it is that you are doing in terms of supporting the BDS movement among any Israelis that support it.
Thank you.
Yes, my question is...
What's your name?
Yes, my name is Dr. Catherine Botha. President of the Garibaldi Foundation. I would like to ask you about the Israeli human rights activists. Are they negotiating with the U.S. government? Because it seems like the U.S. government treating Palestinians extremely unfairly, and I think it's getting worse now.
Thank you. Peter.
My name is Peter Weiss, and I work with the Center for Constitutional Rights and also with Americans for Peace Now. You said, Michael, that some words can be used so much that they lose their meaning. And in my view, that is also the case for the term Jewish values. You talked about Jewish values eloquently, and both of you have done unbelievable work for years for Jewish values, but I think these values are universal. So do they have to be called Jewish? Is that a little arrogant versus other societies that may say, well, Jews believe in dignity, but we don't? Okay, that's one question. And if I may ask quickly another one, it is this. Is the two-state solution dead, or is it merely in a coma from which it may someday recover?
Okay. Thank you.
I'll answer these questions and then we'll get more. Thank you, Mr. Jabbar, for the question about the BDS movement. BDS is a nonviolent, legitimate civil activism. It is one that presents a very big challenge to many anti-occupation activists. I have mixed feelings about the BDS. On the one hand, I do support an act, which means that of boycotting economies and individuals and entities who are responsible for human rights abuse. But the BDS is wider than that, and it captures not only those who are, and it provides sanctions not only on those who directly are involved in occupation-related contributions, but also those who are not. I have examples. I don't want to. While I think it's legitimate, I myself practice a much more focused boycott in my household. I believe that when we put sanctions over individuals or companies, it has to be on those who are directly responsible for the wrong that we work against. At the same time, as I said, I think it's a legitimate way of protesting and way of trying to affect reality and politics. And yes, my office is representing activists who are being targeted because they have engaged in BDS advocacy, and I believe it's their right to do so. And today, Israel is investing a lot in targeting BDS activists and movements, much more than what, Israelis think of the BDS as a much more mightier and bigger thing than what it really is. And that is mainly because our prime minister is serving as the main presenter for the BDS. It inflates the BDS by using it as a monster that wants to annihilate the state of Israel. And so Israel is investing so much in this, as for now, not huge phenomena. And law offices like mine do represent and try to help the activists, both to enter the country and to have their say and not be sanctioned for it. As for the current US administration's treatment of Palestinians, there is very little that I can say that is that you don't know. I'm not an expert on US-Palestinian relations, but I do follow, and as you know, the current administration has been extremely one-sided, to the point where it lost America for the foreseeable future, has lost its place around the table if and when negotiations will resume. The Palestinians, understandably, would not have the United States as the host for these and the arbitrator for these talks. And also, it has in the Trump declaration of acknowledgement of Jerusalem as the state as the capital of the state of Israel has gave a boost to a clear violation of international law. Israel has annexed the East Jerusalem in clear violation of a prohibition that knows no exceptions under international law. And that way, the Trump administration and Trump himself has aspired to take off the table one of the main issues for negotiations between Israel and Palestine, the future of Jerusalem, something that cannot be done unilaterally. And that is very unfortunate. But Israeli human rights activists are not operating vis-a-vis the American administration, so it's your responsibility here to do that. Peter, thank you for both questions. Yes, I think, I'm not sure what was the exact wording that I used, but I think that the main thrust of invoking Judaism is not because in Judaism there is a set of values that you can't find in other religions or cultures. It's because our unique history. And our history should have taught us something about what it is being the different one, being persecuted, being branded as all kinds of things, being a victim of a genocidal conspiracy. So yes, in Judaism there are values which I cherish, and they are universal. And Judaism is one of the cultures and one of the religions that contributed it to the international world. And when I say Jewish values, I want to highlight that in Judaism there are more than those values that are being invoked by the settlers and by the Jewish supremacists in my country. There are other values, older values, that are very much in line with compassionate, humanistic values that other religions have. But what we have unique is 2,000 years of experience of being victims of abuse. And as for your question about the two-state solution, which is definitely in a critical condition, I do believe that the two-state model can be revived, but with some changes. I think one of the biggest problems with the Oslo idea, as it was interpreted by the masses, was that we'll have two states with a big wall between them, and the Israelis would stand every day with their back to the wall and their face to the west, and the Palestinians will stand with their backs to the wall and their face to the east, and we will never see each other and we'll never hear of each other again, and good heavens, we've got rid of them, they got rid of us, and that's it. This is definitely not going to work. And in order for a two-state solution to be practical and moral, it has to have, to understand, it has to acknowledge that these two people will always live together. So I'm, for my part, a member of a group that is called One Homeland, Two States, which advocates an additional component to this two-state solution, a confederative element, and advocates free open borders, and advocates the idea that every Israeli and every Palestinian would be nationals and civilians of their nation state, but also residents of the one land between the Jordan River and the sea, and could reside wherever they want. And again, if you think that this is a fantasy, a science fiction, then I remind you that in only 60 years ago, if you would ask, if you tell a Frenchman that in several years, every German could reside wherever they want in France, and they'll have one currency, and they could work, and there would be open border between France and Germany, they would send you for an asylum. And the Germans and the French and the others in Europe have shed much more blood than we Palestinians and Israelis have. So this is possible. And this is the type of two-state generation two that I envisage.
If I can just add a word about the question of Jewish values. That I look, there are certain things that you don't actually need a legal or religious system to tell you. We could all figure out that it's wrong to murder people. Right? You don't really need anybody. I mean, thank God we have those laws in every system, but you don't really need somebody to tell you that that's wrong. But so there are certain Jewish values that are universal, whether they came from Judaism and came somewhere else, whether they're values that lots of people could figure out. But there's also a very deep and complex system of law. So it's not only about the surface level values, it's also about how those are constructed into a legal system. And for me, a lot of my work has been about resurrecting that legal system and looking at, for example, Judaism has some pretty specific and progressive ideas about how you create a criminal justice system. It's not just about saying dignity for everybody. It's really thinking about what that actually means. How do you protect both the victim or potential victim and also the dignity of the perpetrator? And for every area of law, there's a lot that the Jewish law has to say. And I think there's a value, I mean, as you've done even just in that one example in the book about referencing what Judaism says about collective punishment, there's a lot of, I mean, just like legal systems look not only in their own internal legal system, but also to international law to come up with a richer perspective, Judaism has a lot to bring there as well. Thanks. Okay, so please.
After Second War.
What's your name, sir?
I'm Jew from Russia, that's enough. After Second War, Germany lost a lot of territories, which went to France, to Poland, even Königsberg went to Russia, become Kaliningrad. It was 12 million refugees. Right. Nobody came back. Nobody expect any reparation, recognition of their rights. And that's probably not the most striking example. We talk right now in the country which exists without 5,000 years of history on the land, which belong to completely different tribe. Mm-hmm. And nobody demand everything. Mm-hmm. Why is so different approach to Israel? Okay. Israel did not initiate the war in 67. Mm-hmm. And it was a war intended to eliminate Israel. Right now, radical Islam would do everything what Hitler will do.
So the question
you
is,
have children, I believe.
I do.
Do you believe that your children would survive physically under condition what you try to implement in Israel? Do you believe that neighbors who kill each other in millions and ready to eliminate Muslim and other Muslim would suddenly, with education, with help, change their attitude, change their mind? That's my question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tim Williams, formerly of the Office of the Quartet Representative in Jerusalem. So I'm an occupation addict in recovery. My question comes to your very last point about what happens tomorrow and your friends in Ramallah and your friends, I guess, in Gaza too.
Yeah.
And I take everything that you say about the Israeli responsibility for the occupation, but your friends in Ramallah, if the occupation disappeared tomorrow, would have no freedom of speech. Right now, they're vulnerable to detention, illegal detention. There are many, many things about the present Palestinian regime in Gaza and the Palestinian regime in Ramallah where human rights are simply not part of the conversation. You have an autocratic police state, effectively. I'd be interested in your comment on that as a parallel to all that you're saying about the occupation.
You want to do those two and then take the two, or you want to take two more?
Yeah, and then...
Okay, we can take okay. Both of you.
My name is Margot Viscusi, and I have two questions. They're not related. One is, do you consider the judiciary and Israel to be independent? And the second one is, several people who know Israel well have told me that many Israelis who don't want to speak up have left Israel to live abroad. I know you're not a demographer, but is that a significant trend?
Thank you. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Emma Alpert. I work with Just Vision, and I'm curious, you know, in my work, we think a lot about narratives and media, and we do work on uplifting these stories of the people who are creating the cracks that you're talking about. And what really struck me is something you said about how nearly 30 to 40% of your work now is around defending the defenders. And I'm curious, in your view, does it feel like that is What does that say about the broader field of activism in Israel right now? And is that an intentional, does it feel like that is an intentional strategy from above to sort of shift the narrative away from focusing on defending those who are having their rights violated directly? And in relation to that, what's happened to those, you know, if 30 to 40% of your work has shifted, what's happening with, are there less cases being taken care of, or what's happening with those who are having their rights violated directly? Thank you.
For the Jew from Russia, and I thank you for the question. It's an important question, and we should not should not evade it. Yes, there is a big proportion of Israelis who would say, tough, we won the war. That's our justification. I would want to believe that humanity today, or as Justin Trudeau I saw called it, person kind today, has passed, has developed into a more higher stage in which the question of who has more force, who has more guns, who is more cruel, will be the bearer of rights and resources. And international legal order is an attempt, the post-Second World War legal order is an attempt to make, to have an order in which it's not about military might and military force. You could have, by the way, gone even further in time and not just mention the Second World War with its 12 million refugees. You could go to biblical times where the occupier not only would control the area and pillage the resources there, but also have the occupied as their slaves. So we're not there. I'm happy that we're not there. This is not the way we want to run this world today. I hope that you also don't want to run the world today, because while you are happy that Israel won the different wars that it was engaged in, your moral the morality that you attach to those victories could go the other way around too, you know. So the fact that we won and the fact that we have more force is not a justification for any permanent solution to the Israeli-Arab conflict. As for your other comment about what's going on in the Arab countries, I'm not ignoring that, and I'm not ignoring the security dangers that Israel faces, and I do believe that Israel has to maintain what it needs to maintain in order to protect itself. I would, though, encourage you not to think of security as a single-dimensional concept, which only asks what kind of physical protection we have. Because our security can also and should also be measured on what kind of a promise we have to live up to the values we believe in. And I think that Israel today, unlike several decades ago, does not face any serious existential threat. I think all military experts would agree with me. Unlike in times where Syria or Egypt, where forces that could have invaded Israel, there is no army today that could invade Israel. What we do face, just like here, to some extent, is terrorism. And terrorism, with all its pain that it causes and the way it terrorizes the life of citizens, is not an existential threat. It is a threat to our moral backbone. The way we react to terrorism can bring the downfall of our morality, of the values that we believe in as a society. And so security is not just about our physical well-being, but also about our moral well-being. And in that respect, I think I am a member in the army to defeat terrorism from its most painful, most damaging trait, and that is dissolving our values. Tim Williams, where are you? I of course, share with you the concern for the record of the human rights record of the Palestinian Authority, and even worse than that, the de facto Hamas government in Gaza. And I believe that this is a struggle that has to be fought, but primarily by the Palestinians. I'm an Israeli human rights lawyer. Palestinian society has a wonderful network of human rights organizations, extremely professional and able, and loyal to the ideals of human rights. I'll name several. El Haq, I think they're all partners of the Open Society Foundation, El Haq and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and El Mizan and others. And they should fight against the measures that are placed on them by the Palestinian Authority. I have to say that the Palestinians believe that they are a nation in a war of liberation, and as such, they are in a state of emergency, and this is why it is permissible to quell some of the rights. And very humbly, I would suggest to the Palestinians to take to learn from the Israeli example. We had our war of independence, we were in a state of emergency, and we never, never lifted that state of emergency. For 70 years, Israel is in a state of emergency, and so you can press that button, but it is very difficult to unpress it. So yes, the Palestinians would have to fight for this. This is why I think that our obligation to think of the day after is to think together with the Palestinians. This group that this movement that I've mentioned, One Homeland, Two States, is a one movement made of two groups, Palestinian and Israeli. And we are thinking of constitutional foundations for the two states and the one confederation that will come out of it that would be based on human rights, on separation of powers, on rule of law, and on pluralism and freedom of speech. So thinking of it together is something that I hope would help later on.
And Emma's question.
Oh, yeah. And the question about is there a strategy from above to target the defenders? Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, I told you about my portfolio, but if you'll ask today a director of a human rights, an executive director of a human rights organization about how he or she are managing their time, they would tell you that they invest not only working time to, you know, a lot of working time on defending themselves, on maintaining their space to operate, but also a lot of resources are going to that. Because suddenly, you know, legal proceedings are being invoked against activists and against organizations. Breaking the silence, a group of veteran lawyers who have the very benign mandate of telling Israeli society what they went through and how the occupation looks from their vantage point has been the target of unbelievable incitement by the prime minister himself, who thinks that they are important enough to discuss on primetime television. And in the last 2 years, two legal proceedings were initiated by the government against Breaking the Silence. Once compel Breaking the Silence by a court order to provide the identities of their sources. They lost. But that's what the government wanted.
The government lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a great case to litigate. but it's a frightening idea.
It's a frightening idea that the government goes after an NGO to get its sources, to and then another investigation that was launched against the spokesperson for breaking the silence for a testimony he gave publicly. But what I'm trying to say is, yes, by doing that, they shift not only the focus, the attention, from the occupation to the question of the Israeli democracy, but they also shift resources and time of those defenders from defending others to defending themselves. And it's definitely a strategy.
There's also a question about, is the judiciary independent?
Right. The Israeli judiciary is independent. It does not, that does not mean that the Israeli judiciary, it's not only independent, but it is also professional. So we have judges that are professional judges, that are legal experts in their fields, and they are independent in the sense that they do not get any dictates from the government. However, the Israeli judiciary goes through a tremendous change in recent years because, just like here in America, the Israeli right has identified the judiciary as a very important arm of government and is now changing the composition of the judiciary in a way that in recent years the Israeli Supreme Court has koshered some laws and policies that no other that quell freedoms that no other court in 70 years of our history would ever have koshered. I'll give an example: a law that imposes sanctions on people who call publicly for boycott of settlement produce, for example, a clear clear political speech, the core of being of political speech, is being limited in by law in Israel, and that law has passed judicial review by majority vote of 5-2. Another law that places sanctions on entities or individuals who commemorate the Israeli Day of Independence as the Nakba, as the day of the Palestinian disaster. Again, political speech, which whoever engages in it would be subject to all kinds of limitations. For example, not being able to participate in governmental bids, not getting governmental support or grants, which are very important in the Israeli-Palestinian sector, and those Palestinians who are nationals of Israel, who are, have all kinds of schools and institutions that are by law to be given public funding and would not be able to do that if they commemorate the Nakba. And there are other examples of that kind. This is very disturbing because the Israeli judiciary was a guardian of some of the fundamental freedoms Israelis enjoy. And it seems that it goes to the far right now.
Thank you. Well, I know that the book is for sale outside, right? So if you haven't already bought it, you absolutely should buy it. You should read it. It's really an extraordinary achievement. And I just want to say thank you so much, both for writing this book and also for being here today.
And thank you, Jill, for this. And thank you for being such a big friend and supporter. Thank you.